Spend a few minutes watching this act, and it's clear this Yakutian circus is much different from the three-ring shows that frequent America. There's no lion tamer, trapeze act, or clowns, but what the troupe may lack in gear, they make up for in spirit. Sponsor Tony Scott Pierce says the circus provides a good look at the Saka culture.
They dress in costumes and they perform songs and dance and games that's representative of the entire Saka region. And the people themselves that are in the troupe that are here right now, they are not from one town, they're from the area, the whole Saka region. And they present their circus in a theatrical way. But it's not just kind of a haphazard way, it's really nice. It opens with kind of like a dramatic dance, very serious, almost like a ceremonial dance. And it ends where it's just fun and games. People are just kind of dancing around and having a good time.
The show shares similarities with traditional Alaska Native games like the Eskimo stick pole, works in some juggling, rope jumping, and even crosses into professional wrestling once or twice. The Saka are strongly influenced by Genghis Khan, and horsemanship pervades the show. The performers also exhibit the good enough attitude that pervades much of their nation. Like so much in Russia, they make do with what they have. If the actors don't succeed the first time, they try again. They laugh a lot and tellingly smile at each other when they succeed. The troupe has only been together for a couple years, about as long as their independent government. They're still feeling their way through this performance business, much the way the whole nation's dealing with its new economy. And even though they may drop a few balls, the music keeps playing. The circus performs two shows a day through Saturday. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. When you look only at numbers, 1,000 deaths in 250,000 pursuits don't seem overwhelming, but every fatality touches families and communities, and each one makes the high-speed chase one of law enforcement's high-risk tools. Jeff Alpert is a criminology professor at the University of South Carolina and a national pursuit expert.
There's no such thing as a trivial pursuit. All pursuits are dangerous because what you have is one vehicle fleeing, usually at a relatively high rate of speed, and at least one police and perhaps more than one police vehicle attempting to catch the fleeing vehicle. So you have at least two vehicles going at a relatively high rate of speed, and that is unsafe.
Pursuits aren't safe. Neither are guns. As Alpert says, few people today would suggest taking police firearms away. But in the case of guns and the use of deadly force, there was controversy, struggle over change, and ultimately restrictions imposed on their use, not unlike what's happening now with pursuits.
We went through the same process in 1985 when the U.S. Supreme Court told police officers that they could not shoot non-dangerous fleeing felons. And we went through the same argument, the same discussion. What are we going to do if we don't shoot fleeing felons? They're all going to run from us. You know, how do we train officers not to shoot?
Now the questions are when to pursue, when to call it off, how to make decisions at high speeds on busy streets, and what if criminals refuse to stop? The courts have not ruled as decisively, and police policies are neither uniform nor answering every need. Dennis Kenney, a director with the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington, D.C., cites what happened with a non-pursuit policy in Omaha, Nebraska.
When business people saw the police pull up to a burglary that was in progress, but the suspects got to their car and began to flee, and the police did not pursue, of course the business owners wanted to know why, and when told that the policy prevented such a pursuit, then there was an equal outcry of the police not doing anything to prevent crime.
Still, departments around the nation are trying to limit pursuits. In Providence, Rhode Island, police may only pursue for 6 specific felonies and may not go over 85 miles an hour. Riverside, California deputies pursue only felons and drunk drivers. Los Angeles leaves it up to officers to weigh the seriousness of an offense against the potential dangers in any pursuit. And public opinion rocks back and forth. Jeff Alpert says, predictably, the greater the crime and lower the risk, the more people support a pursuit.
However, when you turn from from felonies to traffic offenses or property misdemeanors, the support falls off dramatically. Similarly, the public does not support pursuits in risky situations or high-risk scenarios.
No pursuit policy is going to reduce risk to zero. Law enforcement is a dangerous business and sometimes dangerous for the public. But the examination of policies, Alpert says, and the imposition of cautions and limits is nonetheless a good thing.
So while they're not safe, they still may be reasonable. And I think that's how we train police officers to understand what the risks are, how to interpret the risks, and put that in policy and training.
And still, police pursuit policy may remain a gray area, always more reliable on paper than on the streets, when any situation may turn risky at any moment. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Occupational Licensing Director Catherine Reardon says big game guides were not happy with the three-day rule. They say planes flying over hunting camps scare animals away. Also, guides are too busy with other clients to visit their assistants in the field.
The new rule is that guides have to communicate with their assistant guides after 5 days of a hunt, and that communication can be either direct and in person or through a third party, such as a pilot or another guide.
The new version of the regulation goes into effect January 1st. That's also the starting date for another change in the regulations, which requires guides to communicate with their clients after the hunt is over.
To find out how the hunt went, whether the services were provided competently and safely. And this is intended to help guides keep track of what is going on in the field when they're not present and to improve their services.
Guides are required by law to visit a hunt site manned by an assistant at least once. Another regulatory change specifies that that visit must come within the first 2 days of the hunt. Reardon says these changes will help the division regulate the competency of big game guides licensed by the state. She knows these emergency regulations came at the wrong time of the year for guides who work seasonally, but the legislature mandated them last year. Reardon says the division will take public comment on the new regulations until September 9th. She expects them to become permanent by the end of October. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Along with volunteering as head of the region's rescue squad, physician's assistant Brent Ursel is director of the McGrath Health Center. Now, as a member of Alaska's Emergency Medical Services Council, he'll also be working with other EMS personnel, doctors, and the general public in developing the policies and procedures by which emergency medicine is practiced in Alaska. Ursel says he'll be an advocate for rural EMS issues, particularly when it comes to training.
For example, with the EMT and the defibrillator part of it, you know, in Anchorage they have a lot of loaner, you know, defibrillators. It's fairly easy to get one, but in order to be certified out here, you know, you have to try and get a defibrillator from one of the training offices and kind of stand in line sometimes to get one of those, and so it's a little bit harder. So this is something that maybe they don't think twice about in the bigger cities, but that becomes more of an issue for rural areas.
Ursel says access to such training is especially important in bush Alaska, where first responders are often that and more.
We don't have any doctors out here. We don't have any surgeons out here. Somebody becomes severely injured, it's up to the PAs, the health aides, the EMTs, the ETTs to try to stabilize that person and keep them alive until they can get to Anchorage. And obviously the better that early care is, the better chance that person has of survival.
Ursel describes the state of emergency medicine in the bush as improving over the last decade, but says he'd like to see more people become involved. Ursel says it's difficult for potential volunteers in small towns to make the time commitment for initial training or to stay current when accidents and emergencies can be few and far apart. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Villato's water and sewer story begins in 1980 with the construction of HUD homes at the new town site. City Treasurer Andy Durney says those homes were supposed to include plumbing, but Nulato didn't have running water at that time. So residents decided to look for some funding for a water system, even though they knew it would be expensive.
We got $1 million as one grant in the early 80s. Then a few years later, we got another $1.2 million. But in the late 80s, the state ran out of money. Everything was put on hold. We had to do work kind of piecemeal because we never got all the funds at one time. And we finally got additional funds in the early 90s.
Thurney says water from the new plant will reach more than half of the community's residents. Sewage from those households will run through pipes to the new lagoon. 65 buildings, including the school, are now online. Most of the homes without running water are located in the old town site, where it's too expensive to reach them. Those people do have access to water and showers at two laundromat facilities, one in each part of town. Durney says the city council is looking for ways to accommodate everyone.
There's other possibilities. There could be like a water haul system or sewage pickup system, but there too, we don't have funds for that now. We are working on upgrading that old laundromat, and we'll be looking at trying to get something for the old town site.
Mulatto's water and sewer project has paid for installation of toilets, showers, and tubs. City Councilman Peter Damoski knows how running water can make life easier.
I don't have to worry about running a mile or so for water, or my kids can, they just love taking a bath every night now and a shower. And it's more convenient. My wife does a heck of a lot more dishes now.
State and federal agencies provided funding for Nulato's water and sewer project, including the Village Safe Water Program. Officials say Nulato is a good example of a united community working towards the common goal of safe water. Durney says it's not clear how the city will afford to maintain this service. A monthly residential fee of $150 will not sustain the system, so the end of Nulato's water and sewer story hasn't been written yet. For now, Durney says at least Nulato residents can enjoy the basics of a safe and healthy environment. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. Most of us are adjusting to a deregulating phone industry. We're already used to long-distance carriers fighting over us, and it doesn't seem odd that AT&T has acquired a local dial tone in Anchorage, positioning itself to compete with APU, or that Pacific Telecom is poised to add Fairbanks to its growing stable of customers. But these are signs of big changes. Deregulation is loosening the reins, and not only for the telephone industry. Mike Kelly is the general manager for Golden Valley Electric Association.
It's a little more difficult to change electric service than it is phone. Just the physical situation, the mechanics of changing are different. But I still think that it won't be long before the customer will be selecting the power company that they're going to purchase the power from, and it may not be the same outfit that owns the lines going down the street.
Kelly says in coming decades, an electric company's geographic location will be much less important than its ability to get power to the people at the best rate.
Obviously, the grid in Wyoming isn't connected to the grid in Fairbanks. We're kind of up here islanded from the electric system of the lower 48, but we're certainly not islanded from Anchorage or the Kenai Peninsula or Seward. That situation allows utilities, for example, in the south central area, to be very interested in loads up here, allows us to be interested in loads down there.
What customers pay for their power will also depend on this emerging competition. Right now, electric companies seek rate approval from the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, but soon they may be asking a new set of questions.
What are the people next door or 100 miles away or 300 miles away selling this product for? That's probably about what I'm going to be able to get for it. And if I want to expand the customer base, I've got to charge less. So it's the commoditization also of the electric business from a cost base to a market or price-based industry.
Kelly says GVEA has worked hard to get its rates in line with Chugach Electric and Anchorage Municipal Light and Power, companies in the best position to compete for interior Alaska customers.
And in 1997, that's really what we consider the crossover year, where our rates are virtually competitive you know, throughout the state. We whip most of the competition and are right on with, say, MLNP and Chugach, two of the two largest utilities.
The horses aren't running yet. Right now, every utility in the state has a protected service territory, from Golden Valley to the municipality of Bethel. But those protections may not last. Had House Bill 273 passed last year, the protections would have disappeared. Kelly believes it won't be long before they do. And with the loss of protections, there will be a downside.
I believe that as you deregulate the electric industry and the cherry picking and the stranded investment occurs in our nation that is bound to occur in that sort of an environment, we'll have a tough adjustment period. And there'll be some impacts on residentials in particular in areas where the good customers are picked off and the others are left stranded.
It's an issue facing the state legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The city of New Lato started working on getting running water 16 years ago. City Treasurer Andy Durney says the project will probably end up with an $8 million price tag. Now that 65 buildings, including the school, are online, it's not clear how the city will afford to maintain the service. Durney says a monthly residential fee of $150 may not be enough.
We have some funds available in reserve that would help us out, but of course, in the long term, they're not going to be there all the time. And I don't know what'll happen if the system becomes too expensive to operate.
In the meantime, more than half of New Lato's residents are enjoying the luxury of showers at home and washing dishes whenever they feel like it. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
One. Nearly all life on Earth is dependent on sunlight. But for nearly two decades now, scientists have known that some species can live off chemistry and heat radiating from the hot fissures on the ocean's floor. Magma welling up through these cracks spread the continents apart. The magma also creates a hot chemical cauldron when it meets nearly freezing ocean waters above. Marine biologist Cindy Vandover says just over 10 years ago, scientists discovered vents in the mid-Atlantic that were home to an incredibly dense swarm of shrimp.
They were described as looking like maggots swarming on a hunk of rotten meat.
As a graduate student at the prestigious Woods Hole Institute, Vandover was given the task of explaining why the shrimp thrived in the black depths.
The animal's called, it was given the scientific name, Exoculata, species name, which means without eyes.
Though they lacked the black beady eyes of most shrimp, Vandover noticed they did have reflective patches on their backs. She suspected they were eyes, and it turns out Vandover was right, but they're eyes that can't form images. That raised another question in her mind. Many creatures on the seafloor can briefly illuminate the black ocean depths with their own light. It's called bioluminescence. And Vandover wondered, was the shrimp eye designed for that?
But if that were the case, why have such a highly modified eye when a normal shrimp's eye can detect bioluminescence? So we thought, well, maybe there's some other weird source of light on the seafloor.
Since the shrimp only cluster around hot vents and all warm bodies emit an infrared glow, Vandover and her colleagues theorized the shrimp were detecting that. Scientists modified a sensitive military digital camera that can detect different bandwidths of light, then descended to a hot vent off the coast of Washington State to snap a picture.
And we got an image of this glow, and it's this very diffuse light coming out of the orifice of a chimney. It's a very localized source of light.
What surprised Vandover, though, is at certain wavelengths, the vents are producing nearly 20 times more light than equations predicted. The question now facing the scientists is, what is creating the light? Dr. Alan Chave, Vandover's colleague, is now designing instruments that may answer that question.
If we can get better information about what the spectral content of the light is, and also information about where the light is coming from, whether that light is, for example, is coming from the very throat of the vent where there's lots of hot water, or further up where there's more chemical reaction going on as the hot water hits cold water and you get the black smoke precipitating out.
Chave is working with an astronomer to design a light-sensitive camera that can see at nine different bandwidths. The scientists expect to take that out to sea next year. For Vandiver, who's a biologist, the light also suggests an intriguing possibility.
And the first thing, of course, that came to mind is, could there be photosynthesis on the seafloor? What a phenomenal thing to even imagine. And again, I was poo-pooed. I was like, oh, that's a stupid idea, Vandiver. What a dumb idea. So it seems to be the story of my life that all my great ideas get nailed right at the beginning. But that doesn't stop me. I persist.
Before she can answer that question, however, Vandiver and her colleagues are funded to return to the ocean bottom to analyze the light spectrum of the vents. Only after the scientists answer what's causing the light will she try to tackle photosynthesis in darkness. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. It's rare for an author to spend quality time with a top agent, editor, and marketing expert, not to mention some of the cream of the nation's writing and illustrating talent. This week in Fairbanks, about 80 writers of children's books will get to do just that. Among the luminaries is Amy Ehrlich, who's written across the genre, from picture books to novels for young adults. Also former editor-in-chief and now consulting editor for Candlewick Press, Ehrlich sees an editor as a writer's first reader.
So if I read something and it's not making sense, or if it's unclear, I get to say to the author, I don't understand this, or you're not making these connections clearly enough, or you're not developing this part as much as you might want to. And it has to be a dialogue from that point on.
The fruit of that dialogue works its way through the perspectives of marketing and salespeople, booksellers and librarians before it finally reaches a child's hands. When it does, that child is likely to find themes that are both universal and timeless.
Being with a family, being with sisters and brothers, you know, very early interactions with other children, certain kinds of fears, fear of the dark, you know, fear of being alone. And it's the same reason why fairy tales never go out of fashion, because they really address very, very basic kinds of issues for children.
Ehrlich will work one-on-one with writers this week. Saturday, she'll give a lecture on The Editor's View. Conference headliners also include agent Marilyn Marlowe, art editor and illustrator Nanette Stevenson, and the keynote speaker, award-winning author Jane Yolen. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The post office will not mail a package over 16 ounces unless it has been processed in person. Customer service supervisor Shirley Copenhauer says the new regulations were mandated by the Federal Aviation Administration, which is trying to make it harder for people to send bombs through the mail.
We are following the guidelines of the FAA. It's a requirement now. It isn't something that we are making a decision on or that we are... it's a policy of the Postal Service. This is coming in through an FAA requirement to take important steps to have the mail prepared and willing to pass their safety and security levels on the airlines.
The Post Office calls any mail weighing more than a pound targeted mail. Targeted mail is stored separately. International and military targeted mail must include a return address and, in some cases, a customs declaration. Copenhauer says metered mail processed at offices or agencies will not fall under this category. Metered mail is registered with the post office and can be traced back to the sender. For the most part, postal customers will not notice the change, but Copenhauer says some may have to alter their habits, especially during the holidays.
A lot of people send a box of cookies. Maybe grandma sends a box of cookies up here or wherever, and there's not much weight to it or anything, and they just put stamps on it and place it either outside, in the mail receptacles or whatever.
Any targeted mail found in a mailbox will be returned to sender. Copenhauer says the postage may be reused, but the package will have to be handed over to a clerk in person, which may make for longer lines at the post office and more work for postal employees. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Some of the fire crews and other people sent to fight the fires are from the Yukon River villages of Ruby, Galena, and Nulato, as well as Huslia, Kaltag, and Allakaket. BLM fire spokesman Andy Williams says the state of Alaska and BLM manage 73 fire crews from 53 villages.
These crews are trained and identified and ready to go on just a few hours' notice when they're called to fires. During the last week, the Interagency Fire Coordination Center here in Fairbanks has called 40 of these crews to send to the lower 48. Right now we have about 1,200 people down there fighting fires.
When the crews arrive at their fire site, they can expect to work for 3 weeks and up to 16 hours a day. William says the Alaska crews are used in basic firefighting where there's a lot of mopping up to do.
We use Pulaski's, axes, shovels, pumps, and various other apparatus to help put the fire out. These crews are used primarily on extended attack, meaning that they're used for large fires that can't be put out by the initial attack forces that we send in. These include smoke jumpers and hotshot crews, as well as engines and aircraft with retardant.
At the end of 3 weeks, if they're still needed, a crew can vote to stay longer. Otherwise, they're rotated back to Alaska and replaced by a fresh crew. Area firefighters working a full 3 weeks can bring home more than $4,500. At last report, the Ruby fire crew was fighting a fire outside Spokane, Washington, and the Huslia crew was expected to arrive there from Oregon this week. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Handpipe accented Brazilian beat of the Fairbanks bass group Toyos to the Celtic melodies played by the talented Anchorage students of Evergreen and the all-American blues of Fairbanks's Roger Leff and the Erratics. McGrath fairgoers got down to the sound of music Saturday.
I liked Evergreen. I really enjoyed their music, and it was quite relaxing.
I enjoyed Roger Leff's band. It was really nice to have Toyos.
They were great, all of them. With the world beat backdrop, toddlers, elders, and everyone in between enjoyed the rest of what this year's McGrath Fair had to offer. Raffles, a cakewalk, prize produce and arts and crafts, kids' games, and food. And what has been a dreary summer, the sun even broke through, as if to tip its hat to McGrath Fair founder Francis Mitchell. As the University of Alaska Fairbanks cooperative extension agent for McGrath, Mitchell organized the fair for 17 years. He's officially stepping down this fall and was recognized for his dedication at a closing potluck Saturday night. The fair will continue thanks to committed volunteers who work for months to raise money and solicit performers prior to each year's event, and then stay up all night on its eve to accept and judge entries in a myriad of categories. Community members like McGrath's Judy Steves enjoy the results and appreciate the efforts which make the McGrath Fair possible.
It's just a fellowship and people getting all together to work hard and to make it happen.
In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Three, two, one. Any night on television, you see police roll up on a crime in progress, the bad guys race away with guns blazing, and the cops chase them down between commercials. It's action-packed, edge-of-the-seat stuff, but it's not real. While no one tracks police pursuits nationally, community and state records show most are triggered by traffic violations or misdemeanors, and that the chase is rarely what solves serious crime. Dennis Kenny is research director for the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington, D.C.
The majority of crimes are either closed through investigative effort, or even more often the research shows they're closed. Suspects are caught because in some way citizens become involved and either tell the police who the suspects are or provide sufficient evidence that the police are able to learn the suspect's identity.
Nonetheless, there are hundreds of thousands of pursuits annually. Police Chief Mike Pullis cites 4,100 just in Fairbanks between January and July this year. Most of those are start and stop. The officer hits the lights and siren, and the other car pulls over. And Kenny says many departments also call off pursuits if officers think they can make an arrest later. But even the most controlled situations can change the moment the other driver hits the accelerator. University of South Carolina criminology professor and pursuit expert Jeff Alpert says when that happens, a police car is a stress box.
There's an adrenaline rush of excitement. There's what we call a contempt of cop. In other words, you're not doing what the police officer has ordered you to do, and that doesn't sit well with police officers. There's this adrenaline dump we talk about that physiologically takes over, and of course police officers are sworn to enforce the law and will do so, and sometimes don't think about public safety consequences.
If stresses are unavoidable, Alpert and Kenny agree that policies, supervision, and training must protect both public and police. Most training emphasizes driving techniques, but as community and police concerns rise over accidents and deaths, Kenny says there's a new focus on decision-making.
How an officer makes a decision, how the officer balances the risk to the public, the risk to themselves, against the need to apprehend a suspect. So it depends upon the nature of the crime, the physical conditions, road conditions, the area of the community, the conditions of the vehicle, the extent of training, and the options that are available to the officer once the pursuit begins.
The most important options, he says, are mental and emotional.
So that when they begin a pursuit, they actually have a plan on how they're going to go about ending it.
States are also weighing in with pursuit-reducing legislation. A Utah law makes what's called a rebuttable presumption that the driver of the car is the car's owner and the responsible party.
So the assumption is that the owner is the driver, and if the way the owner escapes that responsibility is to be able to identify who in fact was.
Some states are also raising penalties. Alpert says the two strategies work together.
Fleeing a police officer should be a very serious felony, and in fact could carry mandatory jail time. But if that is not coupled with a rebuttable presumption, in other words, if you get a license plate or are able to, through good investigative work, figure out who this person was, then you're going to encourage people to run.
And Alpert's research shows about 10% will run if they know the police won't chase them. Police work has never been safe or certain. In times of tight budgets, one certainty is that police work requires new policies and better training for tough decisions, and more time and money spent on investigation after the shift ends. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Urban Rahoy is waging a fast campaign to represent the voters of House District 32. He says a week's worth of handshaking and talking with them should be enough to make a decision. In fact, he hasn't even collected any campaign contributions. Rahoy, who owns a mobile home park and a construction company, says he's running for the Republican nomination to give the voters a choice. He's a conservative and criticizes legislators for passing too many laws.
People always go down and they keep bragging how many laws they pass. My philosophy is just like the policeman in a town. If he can keep the peace without arresting a lot of people, he's a good policeman and he's running his setup good. And I look at the laws the same way. If we can run this country without having a tremendous amount of laws and enforce the laws that are really do a good job, and of course we got to have judges to enforce these laws to take care of this thing.
Rahoy says too many laws and too many regulations are hampering development. He worries that the economy suffers when too much money is spent on the service industries.
We're a service nation and we don't have any industries or any of that. We would be a nation that is nothing, because once you lose all your basic industries, a lot of people think we can go on and do like what we've been doing these last years. But if you don't develop the minds and develop the basics, there is no economy as far as I'm concerned. We can't serve each other forever.
Incumbent Al Veazey has been challenged by Rahoy on the primary level twice before. Veazey's looking for a chance to go back to Juneau and dig deeper into the issue of juvenile crime. He cited the modified juvenile waiver law as an example of necessary legislation. The new law treats 16 and 17-year-olds who commit violent crimes as adults, but Veazey doesn't think it goes far enough.
We need to take that, lower the age down to 12 or 11. I mean, if it is a juvenile, if they are amenable to rehabilitation, they do have a burden to prove to society that they are amenable to rehabilitation, and if they're not, then they should be treated as adults just to protect society. It should be expanded to go beyond crimes of violence, to all felony crimes.
Veazey says laws calling for strong punishments will deter crimes, but he also advocates increased educational opportunity. But he says our system needs some changes.
I believe that choice is a very important element to enter into our educational system. We know for an absolute fact that our K through 12 educational programs are the laughingstock of the industrialized world, and at the same time, our higher education institutions, our colleges and universities, attract the top students from all over the world. And this is because our higher education institutions are based on choice. Students have a choice as to what school they go to. Parents have a choice as to which school they send their children to. Teachers have a choice as to which school they teach at, and administrators have a choice of which school they work at.
Veazey says legislators can create a system where students could choose which school they wanted to attend. He points to charter schools as an excellent idea, but says the legislation forces the schools to act as a satellite to local school districts. Veazey has collected contributions of $29,700 as of July. 29 individuals have each donated more than $100 to his campaign. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. Delta City Councilman and University of Alaska employee Bruce Grossman wants to play a role in strengthening the House Republican majority. As a first step in Juneau, he would work to end state-funded abortions. He calls Alaska's most pressing issue its moral crisis.
And all of the negative indicators of our culture are way up. We've got high suicide. We have high depression. We have high joblessness. We have so many of these indicators that actually relate to us drifting away from our moral center.
Grossman says the size and cost of government must be reduced and believes state workers can suggest the best places to cut their own departments. Until that essential job is done, he will not support new taxes or seek new sources of revenue for the state. When it comes to university funding, he'd hope to see the federal government turn over lands to the college.
At the same time, the university needs to demonstrate a willingness to develop that land which it already has and the new land which it'll get to support itself. There are very few citizens that don't feel that the university is not doing enough to help itself as a land-grant institution.
Former District 35 Representative Harley Olberg has been growing grass seed in Delta for the past decade. He worked 14 years in banking and wants to put his experience to use getting the state's finances in order. Olberg's most immediately concerned with Delta's future once Fort Greeley closes.
That was a big issue a year and a half ago or so when it was announced, and now there are a few people working diligently in the community coalition toward trying to map out a future for Delta, but very little is happening legislatively, and I think more could happen. I think more should happen.
Olberg says if the state acquired the fort as an investment, it could make a suitable headquarters for the gas pipeline, a prison, or a rehab center. Otherwise, he says financially, Delta's future is grim. Olberg calls himself a Republican by nature, fiscally conservative and independent.
I like to think there's still room in this world for a pro-choice Republican, just as there's room for pro-life Democrats. Right now, I'm not so sure that space is available, but quite frankly, I hope that after I win the primary, when I win the primary, if I win the primary, that I will be able to work closely with the Republican Party.
With about $2,400 in hand, including one contribution from Anchorage Representative Cynthia Tui, Olberg hasn't done much campaigning yet. He says if he survives the primary, he'll begin fundraising at that point. Bruce Grossman has raised about $530 to date and has spent about $475. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. 3-2-1. North Pole resident Bill Lewis is retired. He served 3 years as state director of agriculture in the 70s, has worked as a plumber and an electrician. Saying he wants to give something to a state that has given much to him, Lewis cites jobs as his first priority. He'd like to see agriculture, mining, and logging all developed by small operators and without much interference. He says his own experience shows that fast-growing interior trees can reforest themselves.
When I homesteaded my piece of property that I live on, a fire had come through and there wasn't a stick of wood on it that hadn't been burned. And right now I have harvestable trees on it 40 years later. So without any game, any management at all, our forests will always come back.
Lewis supports a property tax reduction, no sales tax, and no income tax. To raise revenues, he would cut state expenses.
What I would do was see that we had at least a 10% across the board salary reduction, and streamline each program. I hate to lose programs, and in order to balance a budget, I think some programs are going to have to go.
His opponent is John Skillbred, a machine operator at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. Skillbred also supervises umpires for the North Pole Little and Senior Leagues. He'd start cuts with legislative per diem rates and travel budgets, and ask for similar cuts from university administrators. For other cuts, Skillbred says the Interior delegation should consult the people.
They need to meet together in an open-door session with their constituents. They need to listen to their constituents and together work towards things that they have a common bond with.
Skillbred calls a state income tax the most viable means of creating revenue, but says he'd hold off on it. In the meantime, he does support higher sin taxes, especially on alcohol, which he says could raise revenue at the same time it reduces social problems. Like his opponent in the primary, Skillbred supports small operator logging in the interior and would give priority to already established local firms over large commercial interests. He says he'd also like to see an in-state recycling operation.
An aluminum recycling would just be the tip of the iceberg in terms of what could be encouraged in the state of Alaska. In the lower 48, recycling is almost a natural consequence. And I think it would, in the long term, it would save us money by keeping our landfills from filling up as fast as they do.
Skillbred is running a shoestring campaign. He's raised and spent about $300. Lewis started his race with a $10,000 personal bank account and so far has spent about $2,000. The winner of the primary confronts two-term legislator Jeanette James in November. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Forty years ago, Bob Boko took a one-year position as a school band director in Kodiak. The job became a career, and Boko made Alaska his home. He's lived and taught in the Fairbanks area since 1959, and he says he's learned from his teaching experiences and his tenure on the Fairbanks Borough School Board that he's able to find answers to people's questions. Boko says natural resource development should be a priority for the governor, state agencies, and the legislature. But he says lawmakers also need to regulate the developers.
They passed this timber bill. My one caveat to it is that they have to have somebody that will take care of that forest and reforest that place if they start cutting. Otherwise, we're going to be in a place where we have just hills that are denuded. And I don't feel that is good.
When it comes to balancing the budget, Boko says legislators have to find out what services Alaskans want the government to provide. He doesn't advocate across-the-board cuts.
People are saying cut, cut, cut. But unless you look at everything and everybody has to justify what they're doing, and they can justify it, then it has to stay. It should stay. And there's a difference between what we need and what we want. And the people have to make that particular choice, what we need and what we want. The Constitution only says we have to fund the essentials.
Boko's opponent, Judy Reese, agrees that the state's budget needs fine-tuning. She compares running the state to running a household.
As a mom at home, I was able to say, we can't eat steak. We're going to have to start eating more pea soup. Nobody's saying we're going to starve. We're just saying we're not going to be able to eat as much steak as we used to. And we're not going to have new prom dresses. And we're not going to be able to go to the movies as often as we'd like to. And we're not going to be able to do some of these things. But we still have four walls and a roof. We still have the ability to pay the electric bill. And we're still going to have a comfortable life in Alaska.
Reese came to Alaska in 1955 and attended Lathrop High School. She returned to the state later with her husband, living in Juneau, Bethel, and Anchorage before moving to Fairbanks in 83. Being a mother comes first for Reese, but she's also worked as an educator. She's been a substitute and a teacher's aide in various school districts. Reese says she's not a single-issue candidate. For example, she's a Republican who's pro-choice.
I don't feel I have a right to speak for anybody else. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I think that to be pro-life or pro-choice is a very personal, private thing, and I just don't see how it should be in the party platform or in any kind of party's platform. I think this is a personal, frequently it's a religious thing, it's a personal thing, and it should not be in our party's platform.
Reese is running on a limited budget. As of late July, her campaign had raised $1,355 with only two contributions of more than $100. Boca was running with a pot worth $3,200. Four individuals had given more than $100 each to his campaign. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Hal Hume spent 15 years as a state trooper, managed a pipeline camp, and served as a regional director for the State Division of Transportation. He sold real estate and hosted a talk show on radio station KFAR. He openly opposed a $64 million school bond issue that voters recently approved. Schools, he says, need to do better.
I feel that the education system really has to become more accountable for the product. I don't believe that our primary and secondary education system is really producing the quality of student that we need to produce.
Hume has served on several education-related organizations, but that's only part of his campaign. He wants to see more firearms training, supports the NRA, and wants more enforcement of drunk driving laws. And he points to the fight over oxyfuel as evidence that he can make a difference.
As a chairman of the oxyfuel committee, we were able to have oxyfuel removed from this community until such time as the EPA and the CDC could prove to us that it was not harmful to our health. We were the first place in the nation to eliminate that from our community.
His biggest goal, though, is to reduce government. Having worked at both management and employee levels, he says there are plenty of mid-level jobs that could be eliminated. Hume says if elected and appointed leaders were committed, they could cut government spending by 20% to 30%. He's opposed to any tax increase, including the popular dollar-a-pack tobacco tax, and he doesn't support public funding for abortions. The two candidates share similar views on many issues like juvenile crime, support for the university, and state control over resource management. But Gary Wilkins says there are differences.
My message is, from my experiences here and what I would take to Juneau, is that the state needs to follow the example of Fairbanks. Economic diversification brings strength. We need the ability to be able to cut loose some of our industries and it not kill us.
Wilkin has spent 20 years as a food wholesaler and says when people look for a healthy Alaska economy, they look to Fairbanks because of its mix of tourism, mining, the university, military, and oil field services. As a business owner, he says he understands budgeting and getting things done. For instance,
the ability to run a meeting, the ability to bring people together from diverse points to reach a conclusion, and a conclusion that's beneficial to the majority. That's the type of a leadership I'll take to Juneau.
On abortion, Wilkins says public funding should be looked at, but he doesn't want to see women forced into back alleys. Based on campaign reports filed with the state, Wilkins has a broader and deeper support base. At last filing, Wilkins had taken in more than $21,000 with 26 contributions over $100. That includes $1,000 checks from Steve Frank's campaign coffers, Frank's lobbyist wife, Linda Anderson, car dealer John Immel, and Exxon's Mark Boudreau.
Hume reported about $14,000. 18 people have given more than 100, with only $1,000 contribution, that from KFAR owner Frank DeLong. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. The Regents last took up the question in 1993. In the months before, students statewide had pushed Regents to include the words sexual orientation in the university's non-discrimination statement. Last time, the Regents remained split and in June of 93 agreed to a policy that avoided sexual orientation by stating that employment decisions will be based on an individual's qualifications and performance. But Regent Joe Hayes says students remain unsatisfied.
You had factions and the Anchorage community, their students, and some students in Fairbanks and so forth who felt that the inclusionary language was not enough. The Coalition of Student Leaders, which is the group of students, the 13 leaders of the university campuses as far as their presidents and so forth, we had gotten together, and I'm the spokesperson as the regent, and they voted in October of 1995 to bring this issue up again.
In June, Hayes asked the Academic and Student Affairs Committee to revisit the issue. It referred it to the Human Resources Committee, which asked the Regents to consider the suggestion at its September meeting. Regents' meeting in Valdez last week agreed to discuss the issue in September, but Dan Ogg used parliamentary procedure to put off until then even considering the question of discussion. Hogg was unavailable for comment, but supporters who want to change the university policy have a difficult path ahead. The terms of three supportive regents expire next year, while opposition regents, who make a majority of the board, remain on in service until at least 1999. And a bigger issue remains for regents regarding health benefits for domestic partners. The university opposes granting health benefits to unmarried couples, and the governor recently signed legislation allowing the university to deny such benefits. But the school still covers domestic partners pending resolution by the state Supreme Court. The court's expected to rule on the matter by the end of the year. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Biologists expected around 630,000 chum to return to the Yukon River, which would have been plenty for normal fall subsistence needs. But they now put the actual number of returning salmon at closer to 700,000. Biologist Keith Schultz says that means commercial fishermen will get a share, an economic opportunity they've missed in recent years.
Well, right now our targeted commercial harvest for the fall season is the low end of each district's guideline harvest range. And the combined guideline harvest range for all the districts is approximately 73,000 fall chums.
Fishers on the lower Yukon have been scooping up chum since last Tuesday. Earlier this week, commercial periods opened in the Galena and Ruby area. And today, most of District 5, from Tanana to Fort Yukon, opens for commercial fishing. Schultz says the competition for the harvest decreases at this time of year.
They're the same fishermen, except for some fishermen do drop out. In other words, the effort is a little bit less in the fall season than it is for the summer Chinook and summer chum run.
A late coho run should overlap with the chum openers. Schultz says the state's management plan targets fall chums, and any cohos caught are considered incidental. Salmon prices on the lower Yukon are averaging about 10 to 15 cents a pound for chums and 25 to 30 cents a pound for coho. Fishermen on the upper Yukon can expect roe prices at about $2 a pound. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
We have 15 Russians who will be a key part of this year's conference. They're sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage, and it's the group is called the Sakhalin International Theatrical Chekhov Center Russian Performers, and they're going to be doing a Sam Shepard play, which will be unusual, particularly because it'll be in Russian. We think this is a conference that has something for everyone. If they want to watch, if they want to be involved in a workshop, if they want to present a play, we are having our play lab again, and on Wednesday and Sunday, readings of original new plays by Alaskan playwrights will be the featured events. And that was so successful last year that both Bill Hoffman, the playwright, and Michael Warren Powell are returning to monitor that activity. And it's an incredible opportunity for new playwrights to get feedback.
2-1. State law says a school district has to meet a special student's requirements. Each student is tested on an individual basis by healthcare professionals, educators, counselors, and other people who can provide beneficial information to find out what's best for that child. Galena School Principal Steve Musser says the district wants to go beyond a state-mandated minimum for a student. He says, for example, a family member with sign language skills could interpret in the classroom, but they wouldn't have the teaching skills to challenge the student. So the district is looking for a deaf interpreter to join the staff and work with the school's one deaf student.
We don't have the talent base to draw from, so when we have a position open and we want to get somebody in, we put out a job notice here in town. We put it with all the universities in the whole nation that train deaf interpreters. We put a listing on their job board. We contact the Teacher Placement Center in Fairbanks, let them know we're looking, the deaf school in Anchorage, and we just put it out there and see who answers.
Bush school districts will also contract with specialists on an as-needed basis, like bringing in a speech therapist. Musser says in this case, the district has hired a deaf interpreter for the first 5 weeks of the school year. There is a chance the interpreter will stay. If not, the district will start the search again until the job is filled. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Power plant employees were the first group to oppose the sale. They feared losing their jobs. But with Usabelli Coal closing in on a deal to run the city power plant, employee opposition is fading. Next up, the Ratepayers Alliance, a group of citizens from across the political spectrum that hoped to derail the sale. Co-chair Harold Gillum says ratepayers built the MUS phone utility but stand to gain nothing if it's sold off. As for infusing millions of dollars into the city, he calls that a backhanded tax increase that will be offset by higher phone rates.
I think the thing we always have to remember is that there's no free lunch. That money has to be paid back. We will have to buy back the utilities which we own, and I object to that.
Gillum and other members of the alliance say city officials aren't getting top dollar because they failed to solicit competitive bids for individual utilities. In addition, says co-chair Jerry Norum, the council hasn't tried other ideas that, short of selling the utility, would make it competitive.
The council hasn't followed the advice of its own task forces, which are local volunteers who have studied this in depth, once under Mayor Bill Wally and once under Mayor Hayes and the current council. They haven't taken those recommendations. They also haven't followed the recommendations of their paid consultants.
Norm says on several occasions, consultants have argued the city can be more competitive if it allows utility directors more management latitude. But sale backers say those arguments no longer hold. PTI consultant Brian Rogers says the landscape's changed, making previous recommendations obsolete.
The monopoly game ended in February of 1996 with the passage of the Telecommunications Act. No longer is telephone a monopoly, and we'll see heightened competition at the local level in the same fashion we've seen it for long distance. What that means for FMUS is a loss of customers to the competition and a loss of profits that can no longer be used to subsidize the money-losing utilities.
With the contract signed and most details worked out, city voters will decide the issue October 8th. Both sides plan to mount media campaigns in the coming weeks to sway voters in what may prove out as a pivotal point in Fairbanks history. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. As the agricultural hub of interior Alaska, Delta supports a growing cattle industry. But Leonard Thomas and more than 30 of his neighbors claim some of the farmers are improperly disposing of dead cows. Thomas says the remains are attracting brown bears to the area, and the carcasses are near bike and horse trails.
Some local children here, while they were riding on horseback along a main trail here,
smelled from horseback some rotting cow remains, and took one of the children took me out and showed me where it was, and it was cow hocks, a hide, part of a skull, butchering remains, and they were right along the trail. And this is a mainly traveled trail, children, bicycle riders, four-wheelers.
This and other rotting remains prompted Thomas to draft an open letter in June, signed by nearly 40 Delta residents expressing their worries. Then he faxed the letter to newspapers, radio and television stations, and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Thomas says he hoped the publicity would spark the agency into action. And it did bring Stan Reed from the Fairbanks office down to investigate.
The parts, animal parts that we saw had been on the ground a while, and there wasn't any evidence at that time that there were bears attracted to what we were seeing on the ground. But there certainly has been evidence in the past, and ample evidence in our files, that there have been carcasses left out and that have attracted bears. People have videos of bears being attracted to animal carcasses.
Reed says things used to be worse in Delta, and he believes the recent notoriety will probably discourage area farmers from illegally disposing of animals and butchered remains. Scott Miller is the largest cattle owner in the area, and he says he always takes his cow carcasses to the landfill. While he doesn't know about any of his neighbors who've been negligent, Miller says he's upset about the bad publicity.
I'm going to take it upon myself as local Farm Bureau president to mention to the farmers that we need to watch over our image, and we need to police ourselves, and you know, there's just no need for this happening.
Meanwhile, Leonard Thomas is now hopping mad about a public letter the DEC issued saying there wasn't a real problem in the area when their own agent says there is. Stan Reed of the DEC says that's just a misunderstanding and has drafted a new letter clarifying the issue. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.